Ticonderoga Farms et al. Versus Knopp et al. Scott A. Surivel, Appellant's Counsel. Michael W. Robinson, Appellee's Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Can I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Sure.
Great, thank you. May it please the court, this case that's before you today involves the wrongful dissolution of a limited liability company that owns about 900 acres of land in basically in Data Center Alley in Loudoun County, where land's currently selling for about $4 million an acre, over the objection of its 72% shareholder. And we have a situation here basically where the Court of Appeals and the trial court thought that the majority rule basically goes out the window, but the way it constructed the two statutes in play here, the dissociation and the dissolution statute. And from my client's perspective, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals in this case basically completely ignored this court's ruling in the Dunbar case. If you look back at the Dunbar case, the opinion by Justice Keenan, that was a case involving a 50-50 ownership situation, not a 72-23 or 72-27 like this one. But in that one, your honors held that they had to show that it was that dissolution is an extraordinary remedy, and they didn't show that in that case, and you all reversed and said the dissolution was improper, basically the corporate death penalty. Now, if you look at what the court held in this case, first of all, it's our client's position that the court wrongfully denied dissociation in the case from the minority shareholders by misapplying the statute.
Counsel? Is the trial court's conclusion that it wasn't reasonably practicable to carry on the business a finding of fact? Do we owe it deference?
No, it's not. It's a finding of law. And if you look at, for example, how the New Jersey court dealt with the situation, which is the case that was cited by the dissent, the New Jersey Supreme Court says that you should look at 7 different factors to evaluate whether or not, in fact, reasonable practicality has been met. I mean, this is a uniform act that's been applied in other states. And the circuit court basically provided very little analysis as to how it reached its conclusion. It just sort of... Well,
judicial dissolution is kind of a nuclear option. I think we all agree on that. In this case, do we have an unusual situation in that both sides to the dispute pled that, at least as it's currently constituted, it was reasonably impractical to carry on the business, one in favor of dissociation, one in favor of judicial dissolution? They both offered evidence demonstrating that it can't continue in its current form. How could we say the trial court was wrong in concluding that it couldn't continue in its current form, given that everybody on both sides of the dispute agreed with that?
Well, I think it's a little more nuanced than that. First of all, I think if you look at Mr. Knopp's contention, if you look at the record of the case, it was not his position that it's completely impossible for the corporation to continue operating a business. The main dispute was whether or not land should be sold. Remember, we're talking about 900 acres where land's currently selling for $4 million an acre in eastern Loudoun County. So we're talking about, if you just do the math, you know, billions of dollars. And that was the thing he cited the most. But in the record, it's also clear that this LLC entity continued to operate numerous other forms of business, you know, like selling bamboo to pandas and, you know, growing stuff for medicine and having a farm for kids to go up and down slides and stuff. And they had parties and it was generating revenue, perhaps not a tax profit, but as many real estate companies don't show paper profits because they're real estate, you're waiting for the asset to depreciate, right? The asset to grow. So if you look at the record doesn't say that Mr. Knopp was saying that the business can't function. He just says there's things he wanted to do with the business that his kids were creating problems, certain things he wanted to do that the kids were making it impossible to do, but not that the business couldn't operate. And if you read the statute, if you read 13.110, or not that 13.1040 is the dissociation, you look at dissolution 47, it just talks about if it's not reasonably practical to carry on the business in conformity with the articles of incorporation and the operating agreement, of which there was none here. And there's no restriction on what this business can do. It doesn't say this is formed for one purpose. It says it can do any purpose, which is what it was doing, continued to do then, continues to do today.
But when asked specifically, could he continue working with them if the minority members were still part of the LLC, wasn't his testimony and this was subject of the motion to strike, and the reason, the part that wasn't stricken was, no, I can't.
That was the answer that he gave, but if you look at the record, it was in the context of, in terms of selling the real estate. It wasn't in terms of, you know, the kids can continue to go down slides, they continue to host parties, they can continue to sell bamboo to pandas and grow stuff for medicinal purposes and all that kind of stuff. The sole issue that he kept raising was he wanted to sell, as the 72% shareholder, the majority shareholder of this corporation, he wanted to be able to sell real estate and that sell some of the real estate. And that's what the kids were creating problems. So I think you have to look at it in context and not just look at that one little narrow, you know, cherry pick two bits that the appellees here in this case continue to rely on.
But beyond the any admissions, you have this years long epic fights are very expensive and time consuming and distracting. So what do we do with that? I mean, because this is not your typical, well, there's a minor dispute over here. I mean, this is just ongoing, and the tone of the emails is pretty, you know, strong and all that. So why isn't that enough to say, okay, we just can't go on?
Well, how many times do other corporations get sued by their shareholders on a regular basis all over the country? Yeah, remember, we're not just talking about this LLC in the context of the opinion you all have to write here. I mean, we're talking about every corporation in Virginia, every LLC in Virginia, and there's lots of corporations that are sued all around America all the time by shareholders for actions by its members. And they don't dissolve every corporation in America just because 1 or 2 or 5 or 10 or 20% of the shareholders are unhappy with the way the business is being run.
But in how many of those cases has the majority shareholder said, in response to a claim brought by one of the minority shareholders, I will sue you until the day I die. I don't care if I bankrupt the company, or words to that effect.
I don't know. Maybe Elon Musk might say that.
I mean, he is the majority shareholder. Yeah,
right. That's my point. That business continues to operate, just like this business continues to operate. Right. I mean, it's not that simple. And if you read the statutory text, you know, the statutory text requires the court to make specific findings. And if you read Your Honor's opinion in the Dunbar case. Your Honor's in the Dunbar case, this court wrote, the statutory standard set by the General Assembly for Dissolution of a Limited Liability Company is a strict one. It's strict.
But is the difference between Dunbar and this case, or a critical difference between Dunbar and this case, is in Dunbar the trial court had already granted dissociation, and therefore the conflict no longer existed when the trial court then turned and dissolved the corporation. But here the trial court reached the opposite conclusion. And so we're left with, if that is correct, we're left with the LLC as it exists with all the members having rights.
Sort of. And in the Dunbar case, first of all, was a 50-50 situation. So it's a lot easier to find deadlock when you have a 50-50 situation. This is a 72-27. And there wasn't even deadlock. The court calls it deadlock. But what happened is, in the record, if you read the record, every time he tried to sell real estate, a title insurance company would say, we're not selling the real estate unless you get these 27% of shareholders to sign off on something. But the deadlock was not in terms of the corporation's ability to make a decision. It was just because of their behavior, real estate couldn't be liquidated. Dunbar was different because it was 50-50, and the corporation couldn't move without somebody breaking the tie between the 50-50 shareholders. And again, if you look at the New Jersey case says that every court should go through 7 different factors to figure out what reasonably practical means, including whether the corporation is making a profit, whether it can continue to do other kinds of business, whether you know can continue to in the nature of the conflicts. I mean, it's a much more nuanced analysis. And I think that kind of a roadmap would be way more helpful for courts and litigants trying to figure out what this means than what we have right now, which is some wide open inquiry where a court can just sort of say, because I say so, without explaining itself.
Regarding your 1040.15C argument, The trial, Judge Sienkiewicz said that there is a causation element inherent in that. It has to be the actions of the member to be dissociated or judicially expelled that has caused the reasonable impracticability. Do you agree that there is a causation element there?
No, I don't agree with that at all. And if you read the statute, the General Assembly specifically excluded the word wrongful from subsection C.
I didn't say wrongful. Mm-hmm. I said causative.
No, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say in subsection C that it has to be specific to anybody. It just can be because these people you know don't get along.
I mean, well, but so if a majority member gets a totally legitimate request for records that the General Assembly has said as a statutory right, you have a right to these records, mm-hmm. and refuses, and that causes the brouhaha, then could a minority member be expelled simply for requesting its statutory rights? I would say that the request did not cause the business not, which makes it not reasonably practicable. The request
I think I'm into my time here, but, sure. but I don't think any court would find that's a reasonable practicality issue. You know, the reasonable practicality issue had to do with the fact that the minority members made it impossible to sell real estate. That's what my client kept saying. He didn't like the records request, and obviously he lost on that point in the trial court. But I don't think making a records request would be a basis to just simply disassociate somebody. But there's a lot of other things that they did that my client complained about that I don't think are disputed. And I guess I'll reserve for rebuttal.
All right. You have 3 minutes and 55 seconds for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Robinson. I appear on behalf of the appellees today. I want to take the two assignments of error in order, and in part because I think when the court looks at and considers the issue of expulsion, and particularly what motivates it and what the effect of it is, it sheds light, it sheds further light and underscores why the decision to dissolve the order of dissolution is in fact appropriate. Two very quick preliminary points. The first, I submit to the court that the assignments of error are improper and the case can be dismissed on that basis. I rest on my briefs on that, but I think in particular the assignment of error one shows the stark differences between what they said the trial court's error was to the Court of Appeals and what they say here. Second, the standard of review. And there's been an argument that this case involves statutory construction and should be reviewed de novo. That issue was also decided in the Tigner case, Dunbar v. Tigner. The trial court's decision here is given the same weight as a jury determination. And it will not be, or should not be, set aside unless plainly wrong or without evidence. And it must be viewed in the light most favorable to the appellees. That's the standard we're dealing with here. Let me address briefly the merits of the expulsion claim. And first, I would submit that the reliance that the appellant places on the Dunbar-Tigner case is misplaced. In that case, this court did not create a hierarchy between expulsion and dissolution. It did not suggest, and certainly did not dictate, that expulsion is a preferred remedy or is a method to avoid dissolution if the statutory basis for dissolution is met. That court stood for the unremarkable proposition that once the member, the bad actor there, had been dissociated, that's when you assess dissolution. And the court decided that the standard hadn't been met. That really has no application here. Here, there was an argument that two bases under the statute were met, the wrongful conduct and then the conduct relating to the company, relating to the business, that makes it reasonably impracticable to carry on the business with that member. Now, only that second one is at issue here. And on that, the trial court made a specific finding of fact. And Justice Russell, I know you asked the question in the context of dissolution, but it also applies in the area of dissociation. The trial court made a specific finding of fact, and it's at the Joint Appendix 6893, and that finding was recognized in the assignment of error to the Court of Appeals, where they said the court erred by deciding that the member's conduct did not make it reasonably impracticable. That finding of fact, fully supported in the record, really puts to rest the challenge to the decision not to dissociate, not to expel. But I think it is important to look at briefly at the claims that were made. One was the issue that the members, the minority members, were asking for records, which is a statutory right. Second was they refused that they each pay $500,000 on a unitary demand. Pay $500,000 each, or I'll expel you.
And set those two aside and address your opponent's discussion of, we have, certainly, if we vote it, the majority member has the right to sell the properties on behalf of the LLC, but as a practical matter, he can't because no title insurance company will insure the transaction.
Well,
could that give rise to conduct that makes it reasonably impractical to carry on the business?
Not in this sense, and I have two responses, Justice Russell. So on the first, the power to vote includes the power to vote no. So even there, I mean, if the issue is it's a 72-28 vote, the power to vote includes the power to vote no.
Right. You've voted no. Right. You've lost the vote. The LLC has authorized the transfer of the property, but you refused to help the LLC carry that out, even though you've had your voting rights.
Well, and on that point, though, the record is silent. All we have is Peter Jay's testimony where he said, well, I couldn't sell because the title companies wouldn't issue a policy. There is nothing in the record. There is no document or evidence of a potential purchaser saying, I need the approval of the minorities. There is nothing from a title company that says we need the approval. And legally, as we all know, this majority member had the legal right to convey title. Title insurance companies typically, to my limited knowledge, but typically they look at the legal right to convey title. And there was a legal right to convey title here, and there's nothing in the record other than an ipsy-dixit statement that, well, I couldn't do it because of the title companies. The other aspect of that Mr. Servell brought up is the notion that they were blocking sales or even voting no. And I think on the one sale that was the subject of the original complaint at issue here, it was for the sale of a property that they call Beaver Dam. And the issue there came because the majority, Peter Jay, came to the minority members and asked for their approval under the following conditions. They wouldn't get their 27% distribution from the sale. He wanted to get more than 90%. They would each get a small fraction. And if they would agree to that, then they would have a unanimous decision. Again, the right to vote no. I mean, that wasn't so much a vote, but a proposal. But it puts in contrast or in relief, really, the relationship here that really required dissolution. Let me touch briefly, and I want to get to the dissolution question quickly, but when I earlier said looking at the dissociation sheds light on the dissolution. Because Peter Jay is the 72%, he has control. Dissociation of the minority members is not going to change that. Dissociation of the minority members may or may not. I mean, the record would be silent on it, but would a title company suddenly say, oh, they've been dissociated, it's okay now, the legal title? There's nothing in the record that would suggest that. But what does expelling a member do for the majority member? He no longer has to provide information. He has to give him a tax return, K-1 at the end of the year. No longer is subject to somebody overlooking the books, overlooking his conduct. And there is nobody that can enforce the rights of the LLC against that member. Because when you are expelled, you lose the right to be a derivative plaintiff. So his request for expulsion gave him what he hoped. absolute control with nobody able to challenge anything. That's why, when you look at that relationship, it sheds light on why dissolution was proper here. On the dissolution, Justice Russell, I submit that the determination as to whether it is reasonably impracticable to carry on the business is a factual finding, and I believe that the Tigner case fully supports that by saying we look at that question as we would a jury determination. It's not a legal determination, it's a jury determination, chancellor or trial court determination. The statutory language here, can it be operated in conformity with the Articles of Organization and Operating Agreement? The view we've heard today from the appellant is that if there's a majority member and it can do anything, there can never be expulsion. There can never be dissolution. That is far, far too restrictive of a view. Dissolution is reserved for those cases that deserve it. And it is a strict, and it should be, for the reasons that we've addressed in the brief. But it is there to serve the purpose, and here that purpose is fully served. We don't have a view of a statute that says, well, as long as there's a majority member, you can't dissolve. Now here, of course, there's no operating agreement. The Articles of Incorporation are a page or two. They shed no light as the Court of Appeals addressed. All we have is the LLC Act. And the meaning of practicable, is it reasonably impracticable? Which would suggest the ability to have something be done, put into practice successfully. Here, the constant litigation positions, and the position in this case, Peter J. asserting that unless the other members were expelled, the company could not continue. His admission that you addressed, Justice Russell, he cannot treat the other members appropriately. Certainly under the LLC Act, there's the not just the contemplation, but the express notion that everybody's going to be treated appropriately, majority and the minority members. You've got Peter J's statements that even if they were expelled, all of the litigation he filed would continue. Not all of it related to the LLC, although he was using LLC monies to fund those litigations. But all of that would continue. And then you have the extensive financial issues that were raised through expert testimony that the trial court found credible and persuasive. Persuasive. You had hundreds of thousands of dollars being transferred from the LLC accounts to Peter J's personal accounts with no explanation. You had claims of millions of dollars of undocumented loans. What does that do for the majority member? Well, loans get paid before distributions get made. And so he's able to say, well, it's not documented, but the company owes me $5 million. I'll take that first. You've got the use of funds to pay for litigation. You had instances where there were pass-through entities to other LLCs that could not be traced. You had one-third of the company's revenues being paid to Peter J. and his second wife as salaries, one-third of the revenue. You had $2 million in retroactive salary paid to Peter J. and his wife. The cynics amongst us would probably think that that might be considered a de facto distribution, and that if you're going to distribute $2 million, you need to look at the distribution for all the members. But it was on the books as $2 million retroactive salary. And at the trial, Peter J. did not challenge that. He made statements about, oh, we'll be profitable, we'll turn this around, we are turning it around. But he didn't challenge and did not bring in evidence to really challenge the financial evidence and then the expert testimony that the trial court found persuasive.
Do you have any thoughts on whether we should adopt the 7-part test that New Jersey has used or not?
Justice McCullough, I mean, I can see at least facially the notion of, oh, we could give additional guidance. I don't think this is the appropriate case for that. But I would also point out that in Tigner and in Dunbar, this court really stressed that this language, the statute can be applied using the ordinary terms. And I would suggest that the test is exactly what happened here. You look at the totality of the circumstances, and you determine, and then the judge has to use judgment, of course. And contrary to the suggestion in the amicus, judges in Virginia don't do things on whims. You look at the totality of the circumstances, and you apply the statute in that. And I think some of the factors that are listed there are things that, in the appropriate case, the court would look at anyway. So I don't think there needs to be guidance here of saying, oh, you must look at A, B, and C, and give the appropriate weight to A and give less weight to C. It really is a totality of the circumstances. So I don't think you need to adopt the test. And I don't think there's anything that we've seen in other cases that dictate that the trial courts need that sort of guidance. I am running very short on my time period. I would like to say that when the arguments are made about the prior three or the last 3 years since dissolution, that of course those are outside of the record. And B, they should be viewed, if they were viewed at all, through the prism of there is a trustee in place. And if that evidence or if that those facts were ever going to be looked at, it would need to be viewed through the prism of this is not 3 years ago. This is with a trustee in place. Unless the court has any questions, I thank the court for its attention, and I ask you to affirm the decision below.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have several points I want to just highlight here. First of all, with regard to my client's statement about the title insurance, that's the record. It wasn't rebutted. There was no evidence presenting opposite, and that's what the record is.
But if that's the only evidence at this stage in the proceeding where all the inferences flow, do we have to assume that the trial court rejected it?
No, the trial court never brought it up. I mean, his ruling was very sparse in terms of what he went in finding. And from my perspective, I don't think he actually found any wrongful behavior on behalf of Peter Knopp at all. He did find that he didn't do a record request, didn't provide the records, right? And then he rejected the claim about the capital call, so you don't have the authority for that. But he didn't find any.
And credited the accountant's testimony that there was insufficient record keeping.
Yeah, he said that what the expert said created enough red flags so that a record request was justifiable. But he didn't say that there was definitely, he didn't find that Peter Knopp had misspent money or misappropriated money or anything like that. There was no finding about that. It was just, there's enough here to make a record request. That's basically all the court found. But anyway, on the title insurance, that's what the record was. Secondly, I think it's really important that when you consider this reasonable practicality stuff, you remember the context. What Peter Knopp said is, in court, is it wasn't reasonably practical to operate with these people. That's not the standard for dissolution. The standard for dissolution is not reasonably practical to carry on the business in conformity with the articles of incorporation and in the operating agreement. The dissociation statute talks about not reasonably practical to carry on with the members. And so if you consider Knopp's statement, he was talking about dissociation. He wasn't talking about reasonable practicality when it comes to dissolution, which they want to try to take one statement about working with members as being not operating in conformity with the agreement.
But don't the articles of incorporation assume that the business will be carried on between the majority and minority members? I mean, by definition?
Doesn't it assume that business will be carried on with members by definition? Well, some are sole. I mean, this one obviously isn't a sole member LLC, but yeah, it has others, but I'm not sure there's anything showing that business wasn't being carried on. If anything, there was a lot of business that was going on. The other thing I would say, if you read Dunbar, I would submit Dunbar is a lot more instructive than counsel gives it credit. In that case, you all reversed that case, saying the record does not show the chancellor evaluated the evidence in light of the fact that Tigner was being expelled as a member and a manager of expert. And then they went on to say that because the court went on to appoint a receiver, and the receiver had operated the company through when the case was argued to this court, exactly the same as here, that showed that the business was capable of operating, which is why dissolution was improper. So that in the Tigner case, they found that the court's remedy was inconsistent with the finding of dissolution. That's exactly what happened here, right? This trial happened 4 years ago, by the way, and this business still goes on. The other things I would just think it's really important to remember about the record in light of the argument is that had been made is that I don't think the court, or my client doesn't believe the court found that he engaged in any kind of misconduct or oppressive conduct. The court also never made a finding that the company couldn't operate. It just found the company couldn't sell land. Also, it's important to remember that these minority owners have remedies other than dissolution. They could sue for breach of fiduciary duty. They could bring a derivative action. They could bring all kinds of other direct actions. Dissolution is supposed to be a remedy of last resort. It's not supposed to be the first thing you go to, which is what happened in this case. And every time a minority shareholder conflicts with a majority shareholder, it can't be grounds for dissolution. The result in this case, the opinion that came out of the Court of Appeals, ought to terrify every corporation in Virginia. And so I think this court needs to provide some real clarity, and the court ought to reverse what both the Court of Appeals and the trial court did and let this company continue to operate. Maybe they'll be back again, but that needs to continue to operate. But thank you for your time today.
Thank you, counsel.